Welcome to Out in the Bay. I'm Eric Jansen. Earlier this week, I went to the African American Arts and Culture Complex in San Francisco to see the exhibit Sugar in Our Blood, The Spirit of Black and Queer Identity. The artist, Ramakan Orwisters, showed me around his installation. It's a series of a dozen or so mixed-media, mostly fabric pieces, woven or crocheted in a style reminiscent of folk art crafted rag rugs by a group of volunteers at his crochet jams. His idea is to bring people together through art. Here's Ramakan.
Well, what I've done is I've taken the folk art tradition of rag rug making, which is what you just said, and I have enlarged it so that instead of just me making rag rugs, I've invited other people to help me make them crossing the span of the LGBT community, across ethnic and racial and age barriers, to help me expand on the idea of uniting people using the folk art tradition of rag rug making. So people also can bring their own fabric. They can donate their T-shirts, their intimate apparel, their sheets, whatever, and we can rip and tear them and crochet them together to make large tapestries. Some of these are 84 inches by 84 inches by 12. So the idea is to take them out of their domestic framework and context and make them large and show them in a fine art context. The idea being that we too are larger than the communities that have stereotyped and divided us.
What pieces have people given you the most reactions to, or which ones have resonated with people the most?
The one that has resonated the most is the piece I call The Trinity. Okay. Which is a large piece that has watermelons that are glass watermelons. It also has my grandmother's washbowl holding the glass watermelons. There is a wedding veil attached to it. At the top of the tapestry, there is images of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, John Kennedy, and Robert Kennedy. And these images, I call it the Trinity, and this was hanging above my grandmother's bed in her bedroom. And so I like the idea of tying these images. Like the wedding veil for me is a symbol of wedding, which is a symbol of uniting, bringing communities together. So I added the wedding veil. And the whole tapestry comes off the wall and onto an ironing board, which is another symbol for me of domesticity. This piece is very autobiographical in another way, because when my grandmother was teaching me how to quilt, we would quilt on her bed, and above her bed would be the I call it the Trinity, you know, JFK and the Reverend Doctor and Robert Kennedy.
All three of whom were assassinated, of course.
Yes. So in some ways, it's a memorial. You know, it celebrates their courage for knowing that there's more important things out there than just worrying about growing old. They were prepared to sacrifice their lives for the things they believed in, which is very powerful, actually. And I feel in some ways that I am also courageous enough to act on my creativity. And a piece like this is one of those symbols for me. When we were making these quilts, my grandmother was teaching me how to quilt. It was a very peaceful, very quiet, very calm kind of experience. And I remember that. And what dawned on me is that here I am, you know, we're talking maybe a long time later, 45 years later, and I am recreating that entire experience, inviting other people, strangers, to come in and crochet with me. Although my grandmother taught me how to quilt, and my mother taught me how to sew using a sewing machine, and it was the same experience. You know, my mother wasn't like saying, you know, do it like this, or there weren't any demands or there weren't any commands. It was pretty much a very gentle kind of like, oh, let me show you, and then, or let me teach you how to do this. But it wasn't very, it was very calming, very relaxing, very peaceful.
She let you have your own way with it and your own creativity with it.
Yes, she did. And throughout the entire time, I was learning how to sew, and I was learning how to cut patterns and all this.
How old were you at this time?
I was probably 10, okay. About 10 or 11 years old. Mm-hmm. I think now I'm the only one in my family that still works with fabric.
Another piece that struck me when I came here the first time was this this wedding piece. So it's a kind of a, it's like, and unlike the others, the rug part of it is all completely white, and it's sort of folded and stacked up with a church hat on top of it, a blue church hat with, I don't know what those are, jewels of some sort. They're not real diamonds, no. And then it kind of trails into another room where there's a, around the corner, where we see part of a, I guess part of a wedding veil and
wedding dress.
Yeah, part of a wedding dress. So what's this one all about?
This is the wedding tower. And so my idea is to use one color, only white. And that could be sheets, T-shirts, intimate apparel, whatever it is, but the color has to be white. And what I noticed is that white also has gradations and shades of white. And that means that also that there's a variation in the patterns, and I wanted that to be seen. And so I wanted also not to rely, I wanted to see how I'm a colorist in many ways, and because the tapestries are very beautiful, and most people are colorists. They're very associated, they're very tied to the associations of colors and how they feel when they use them. I wanted to express an idea of using one fabric, calling it the wedding tower, because for a wedding, again, it's a whole idea of uniting groups, weaving people together, communities, and that's what I'm doing. I'm weaving communities, I'm weaving fabrics, and you can't get more intimate than people's clothes, mm-hmm. in a way. You know, and truth be known, we're, you know, all of us are nude under our clothes, but so I wanted to be able to take the wedding dress and the wedding theme and put it in a different context so that the tower would have a train off of the tower. And then you would follow the train until you see this wedding dress that looks like a tulip upside down, right? Which if it were a flag on a ship or in a naval capacity, it would be meaning that it was in distress, that you were in distress. But I wanted to take the object out of its perceived context and put it in another.
What do you think about the whole push for marriage that the gay community is going through now?
I think, like everything else in life and history, everything is dynamic. It's always changing. And if we wait for other people to do the type of change that we want, it may take longer or it may not happen. So everything has been redefined. The concept of identity, spirituality, religion, the concept of God and divinity, that has constantly been redefined. And so has the concept of what wedding is and who can be married and who defines what love is. If you look at it from an African-American point of view, I mean, the whole idea that even African-Americans couldn't marry at one time. They particularly couldn't marry outside their own race until the 60s. So it's constantly being redefined, right? And we have to push people and our society and our public officials to look at life beyond a concept that only limits themselves and us. Because if you can say some people can get married, others can't, doesn't that in some way take away the whole concept of what marriage is? Even for people who it is allowed to happen, it becomes pretty narrow. But if love is as we say it is and has the impact that it does, shouldn't it be broadened and to incorporate a larger perspective of what love is beyond racial, sexual, and same-sex concepts of what that limitation can be?
You're listening to Out in the Bay. I'm Eric Jansen. My guest is Ramakan O. Arwister, the artist of the exhibit Sugar in Our Blood at the African-American Arts and Culture Complex, 762 Fulton Street in San Francisco. The exhibit runs through September 12th. You can find more information online at aaacc.org. That's for the African-American Arts and Culture Complex, aaacc.org. Ramakan, I noticed when I looked at these fabrics, some of these rugs close up the other day, and when you get close and look at them, you see pieces of underwear and zippers and, you mentioned intimate apparel. What's the, is this kind of breaking some barriers in rag rug art?
Absolutely. I doubt very seriously if I know many people in the context of how I grew up making, you know, folk art traditions would use intimate apparel, G-strings, underwear, T-shirts, not necessarily in their, domestic rag rug for the fireplace kind of concept. But for me, the idea is that I wanted to have a symbol of what I think is separating the LGBT community and the African-American community. And society, from my point of view, has stereotyped our sexuality at the expense of our spirituality. So I wanted to move away from that so people can redefine sexuality and spirituality and using intimate apparel as a way of doing it. Mm-hmm. So if people felt comfortable donating their intimate apparel for the project and cutting it up and sewing it in, that's fantastic. And we have.
How do you mean? Describe that a little bit more. How do you mean that sexuality is one of the things that has divided us?
Because from when I was growing up, the whole idea that being homosexual or queer was outside of the framework. If you were anything other than heterosexual, then you were not necessarily a part of the society, or you're somehow demonized. And that is the paradigm that you have to follow into. That you know, you can't be broad, and it can't be fluid.
Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that that's a debate that's gone on in the black community for a long time. People feeling like they had to choose one identity or the other. You couldn't be both, and you had to sort of choose your allegiances. Is that right?
That is right. For me, the whole idea is like I have spent too much time trying to divide myself up in these categories. You know, too much time of well, when am I black and when am I not? When am I queer and when am I not? And when am I, you know, having to, am I spiritual, religious? When have I been able to take all of these concepts that at one time were frustrating and may have been negative and turn them around? You know, quite clearly being black, being queer, being able to define oneself on his or her own terms is positive. It's a very positive thing, but that isn't necessarily how we are brought up. We are brought up to conform.
So tell us a little bit about your childhood. Where'd you grow up? You told us earlier about your grandmother teaching you how to sew and quilt. Where'd you grow up, and what was that like?
I grew up in 1960, when I was born in 1960, in a small town in North Carolina called Kernersville, North Carolina. When I was growing up there, it was still Jim Crow era. And I remember going to the movies and watching the movie from the balcony. So the whole idea...
Because that's the only place you were allowed to sit?
Correct. We'd have to go to the side entrance. And I remember meeting one of our town friends in the black community named Mr. Miller. And Mr. Miller would point the way up to the balcony. My mother at the time, to keep us from having to, you know, to run out of the car and run into the front of the theater, she would make fried chicken wings. So we'd have something to eat. So we wouldn't be hungry. We smelled the popcorn, and she didn't want us to cause a scene. So we always had these grease stains on our paper bags.
In the days when you were allowed to bring food into the theaters, you can't do that now.
That's right, you can't do that. So it's amazing how things have completely gone, you know, topsy-turvy.
Some things are a lot better, and some things are worse.
Yes, indeed. But I've been very lucky with the whole idea that even though I grew up in Jim Crow era and with my parents, who also have probably grew up in a time where it was much more harsh when it comes to racial inequities, they were still taking my ideas seriously. I mean, my father would allow me to, you know, be creative. I could paint and draw on the kitchen table, you know, as opposed to like, you know, a boy in his, you know, adolescence, 14 to 15, he wasn't pushing me to go out and play football and do all the team sports, you know.
Is that what your friends were doing? I mean, I don't know what kind of, like you said, I don't know how small this town is, but they had a football team. They had a high school big enough for a football team.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And playing tennis. There wasn't soccer, but they were the usual high school sports. But they allowed me to be creative, which I think in some ways meant that they took my ideas seriously, and they were a symbol of society. I was important, mm-hmm. and that's how I inculcated who I am and the world around me, which I think made a very big difference. You know, there were times when my parents, you know, out of fear of what might happen if we did step out and act too much like the white boys who were around us with the privileges that they were allowed to have, they were too much aware, my family was too much aware of the impact of strange fruit and trees.
Well, are you saying by that somehow, like, if a white kid was acting a little bit, you know, different, that would be more tolerated than you as a black kid?
No, what I'm saying is the whole idea of being entitled. Mm-hmm. No, not so much being gay or queer, but being entitled. I'm growing up in the 60s and 70s, you know, before the civil rights movement, the idea of a black boy, particularly taking on the entitlement that was reserved for white boys and white men might be considered a threat. Mm-hmm. And my parents very much knew that. So they raised me, I believe, to be a bit more passive as a way of survival.
Mm-hmm. So, but does that relate to your art in the sense that you could do this artwork around the kitchen table and you could do your sewing around the kitchen table, but you couldn't do that outside of the home?
I wouldn't do that outside of the home, no. It would have to be in a certain context, but I wouldn't be as courageous. I mean, and plus, I was a little boy, so it may not be perceived in the same way. But nonetheless, I don't remember talking about very much when I was growing up that I was learning to quilt from my grandmother and learning to sew from my mother. I don't think I told many people about that, mm-hmm. although it was a very charming, a very endearing experience.
Yeah, I bet. A couple more things I want to ask you about the art here. Now, you had a group of people who came to these crochet jams at the Jam Museum when you were in residency there. Did you come up with the concepts for all these pieces and they just kind of helped you carry them out, or did the concepts evolve from the group as well?
They evolved from the group. My idea is that I wanted to create this an atmosphere that was inviting, peaceful, safe, and that we all have a capacity for creativity. I would teach them how to crochet. I mean, it's just very basic because I didn't want them to be hindered by long or extended patterns. And then I show them how to crochet, and then they're on their own to crochet any color that they wanted, you know, any color or strip that they wanted. They select the colors that they want. I wasn't the artistic director about that. So we're not worrying about it. So everyone would bring their own jazz. They bring their own creativity, and they'd add it where they want to on the piece. And then I let them know that we're not worrying about the outcome. Mm-hmm. We're not worrying about the outcome. So whatever we see, we're going to trust it. Mm-hmm. That is the piece.
And how about the ideas, for example? Like, I see this one over here, which I looked at the first time I was here, and I didn't even notice until, like, you know, 10 minutes or something, that on the top of this thing is sort of a rug rolled up on its side and standing up like a rolled rug vertically, and there's like some, oh, there's a pair of high heel shoes sticking out the top. So is that an idea of yours, or did that evolve from this group, for example?
Well, it evolved from the whole idea of concepts associated with men wearing high heel shoes, with sexuality, with the whole idea of what identity is. And, you know, those are a pair of shoes that I wore on my 50th birthday at a birthday party. So I like the idea of taking things out of their context and putting them in another, in a larger context, and as a surprise. Mm-hmm. So you're looking at the piece, and all of a sudden there's something else that pops out. There's something else that pops out. So you're engaged in the piece, and you're able to come up with your own narrative that's defined on your own terms outside of me as the artist who's trying, you know, not trying to dictate what people think.
You also studied as a minister, to be a minister, is that right?
I did. I was at Duke Divinity School from 84 to 86, and I earned my master's from Duke. Duke was a great time because it taught me how to think critically about the text and the scripture, which was very different than what what I grew up in my hometown in the traditional religious context of authority. If the teacher or the preacher had a certain point of view about the scripture, that carried the day. But in seminary, we were able to intellectually, even going back to study Hebrew and ancient Greek, and they wanted us at the time to be able to not rely on the translations, but to be able to translate for ourselves, given our training. I've taken that a little further. I like the idea of being critical of my sources, not just from religion, but also in politics, in art, mm-hmm. in social and other and political points of view and concepts. So it really changed my whole view of life in seminary in many ways.
But you didn't want to be a minister.
No, I didn't want to be a minister. I decided that I knew I could communicate with my ideas through art at the time. And luckily, my parents allowed me to be able to work toward that. But I knew that at the time I was training to be a minister and I was gay in the church and I wasn't out, I felt that if I continued and towed the line and did everything that I was supposed to do, I would never know who I am. Mm-hmm. And I would always have to define myself outside of my own concept to be able to toe the line for the decisions that I made to be in the church. And I decided that I couldn't do that. And I got my master's, and I left the country. I went to Japan for 5 years. Because I knew when I was in the pulpit wearing the robes before I was ordained and being part of my training, that whatever I said from the pulpit, people were taking very seriously. And I needed to be authentic in my own religious and spiritual framework, because I had a great deal of power, and it scared me. Mm-hmm. So I had to leave.
Okay, fair enough. The name of the exhibit, Sugar in Our Blood. What's that a reference to?
That's a euphemism. Growing up in the South, I remember my father used to say, or he'd point to someone and he'd say, you know, he has sugar in his blood, which is a way of saying he's sweet, uh-huh. He's effeminate, he's homosexual. I don't know if my father knew at the same time who he was talking to, because I think that I may have had more sensibilities with the man he was referring to than either one of us wanted to navigate together necessarily. But that's the reference.
Okay.
And I've taken it out of his or her and put our, mm-hmm. because I think that in some ways we are more sexual than anything else, mm-hmm. I didn't want to pinpoint one sexuality or the other. I said our. So sugar in our blood means that we're all sexual beings, and I wanted to somehow weave this into the whole concept of using intimate apparel, folk art traditions, crocheting, taking concepts out of one area, putting them in another to help people see things differently.
Okay. And the last thing I want to ask you about is these crochet jams. Are they continuing? And what are you working on now? And if these crochet jams are continuing, how do people get involved?
Well, people can contact me through ramakind.com, and you can see my schedule of crochet jams on my website. And they are continuing. I will have one here at the African American Art and Culture Complex on August 30th. From 1 to 5, and people can bring their fabric. There'll be fabric here. We can tell our stories, and we can weave our ideas together.
You can bring your underwear.
You can bring your underwear if you want.
Brassieres, whatever.
we'll weave them right in there. And then some of the tapestries here, I'll take some of them off the wall. We will crochet on them and put them back on the wall.
Wow.
You know, the whole idea of trying to push boundaries, not only externally, but internally as well. So the crochet jams are continually happening. They're happening on the 17th and on August at the Exploratorium. And then in I think September 5th, we'll be having a crochet jam with other events happening at the Academy of Science.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you very much for being here. Thank you for showing me around, I should say.
I'm very happy to do that, and thank you for your interest.
Okay. This is you've been listening to Out in the Bay. I'm Eric Jansen. My guest is Ramakind O.R. Worcester, and the exhibit is Sugar in Our Blood. It's at the African American Arts and Culture Complex at 762 Fulton Street in San Francisco. For information on that, go to aaacc.org or Ramakind's own website. Why don't you spell it for us?
R-A-M-E-K-O-N, ramakind.com.
Very good. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
We close tonight with a short piece from Out Loud Radio's Intergenerational Storytelling Project. In Good, Loose, Free, Elder Jesse tells about expressing himself through his clothes and about tailoring his colleagues in a monastery.
My name is Jesse, and I'm wearing black designer jeans that I bought at Goodwill for about $4. And this shirt, though, was given to me by the Huichol Indians in northern Mexico. As an indigenous person, colors are central to the celebrations and rituals we have. I feel almost like the gay sensibility, if there is such a thing, very definitely in a positive way aligns with my own identity as to who I am as an indigenous person, a spiritual person, a caring person, someone who enjoys life and living it with all kinds of costumes on. I was in a monastery for a while. To their utter dismay, they put me in charge of the tailor shop. So I got to dress everybody. And the first thing I did was, well, I opened up all the closets in the tailor shop, and there were all these, you know, black gowns that had been there for I don't know how many years. They were actually turning green. And all. So I had a friend of mine, a big husky guy from Bakersfield who was a monk. I said, back up your truck. I opened the windows, and I threw all of those out onto the truck, and he brought them out to the grape fields and burned the whole bunch. Well, I did get in trouble for that, to say the least. However, the community loved me because all of a sudden we were having to make new outfits. What I loved about it is I could throw this black, thin, almost like chiffon thing, because I had my parents bring me some really light material. And then we had it made, I threw it on, and I didn't have to wear anything underneath. I could just wander around the monastery grounds in this. I looked very prim and proper, but I felt so good and loose and free. Gay, for me, is like at the core of who I am. Whether I use the word gay or same-sex loving or whatever it is, that's at the core of me. So the core of me is going to be expressed in the colors I choose, the clothing I choose, the spirituality I choose, all of that.
That was Jesse, an elder in Out Loud Radio's recent intergenerational storytelling project. Out Loud Radio is a queer youth training program. Learn more and hear more at outloudradio.org. You've been listening to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. If you missed part of this broadcast, you can hear the whole thing on our website, outinthebay.org, where you can also sign up for free podcasts and get the Stitcher app. That's right, Stitcher, which lets you hear radio programs on mobile devices. You can also hear our most recent shows right on the site, and you can also hear about a dozen of our past favorites from our 8 years on the air. We've been producing Out in the Bay for more than 8 years as an independent production, not a KALW staff production. So we receive no funds from KALW. We need your financial support. It's easy and tax-deductible on our website, outinthebay.org. Hit the donate button and make a contribution, big or small, and don't forget matching funds from your employer. Out in the Bay is independently produced by me and Marilyn Pittman. We thank KALW, our host station, for studio use and airtime. One quick last little thing. If you're thinking you're too cool to work out, boy, have I got news for you. Paige Hodel has been a great lesbian and gay club DJ for 30 plus years. She's starting a new dance party. It's opening tonight, every Thursday from now on, and well, we just hope it lasts because it's got the kind of music I love. Old school R&B, funk, soul, hip hop, soulful house and dance music. It's called Jukebox. Every Thursday night at Beatbox, 314 11th Street at Folsom. And as I mentioned, it's grand opening tonight, Thursday, August 15th. Starts at 9 p.m., so go check it out. I can't be there tonight, but I want to be there next week, so check it out and tell me how it is. Out in the Bay is supported in part by the Bar Association of San Francisco's Lawyer Referral and Information Service, providing legal referrals in over 100 areas of the law, including those most relevant to the LGBT community. Information online at sfbar.org/LRIS. That's for Lawyer Referral and Information Service, sfbar.org/LRIS, or by phone at 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. We'd love to hear from you with segment suggestions, general comments, and questions. So write to us, eric@outinthebay.com and marilyn@outinthebay.com. I'm Eric Jansen. I'm out of time.